Were Solomon alive today, he would have most certainly said that of the making of fictional books and films, at least at Christmas and Easter about Jesus, there will be no end. Now we know that Jesus was married, had a son, last year he had a daughter, and that he is buried in the family tomb in Jerusalem. Next year, his divorce papers will be discovered. Our response to these hallucinations is that he was conceived by the Holy Spirit of the Virgin Mary. As the Athanasian Creed says, Jesus was equal to God and less than God. He was so human that like every other victim of Roman justice, he wanted to avoid crucifixion. In his first prayer, he lets God have the last word. If it is possible, remove this cup from me. In the second one, request is replaced by demand. All things are possible with you. Take this cup from me. No ifs, buts, and ands. God is not a stone. He is not a collection of predetermined motives. The Old Testament is a succession of stories about God changing his mind because people asked him to. All things are possible with God, including changing his mind. At least that's what Jesus thought. In a classroom, most of us at one time or another have been given the response to a question we've asked, that we've asked the wrong question. Someone ought to publish a book with all the wrong questions so that we never have to ask them. With God, there are no wrong questions. There are no wrong prayers. We should learn good prayers. The Psalms are the perfect example of human agony encased in inspired word. The old collects are marvelous prayers, and perhaps they can find their way back into our pew racks. But the greatest prayers come from desperate faith that discovers that God has gone deaf. At the first level, prayer says, if it is possible, take this cup from me. At the higher level is the absolute imperative. All things are possible with you. Take this cup from me. This is the superior prayer, because it contradicts what Jesus knew to be God's will for him. It is the prayer that does not let God off the hook. It is the prayer that is hand-to-hand conflict with God, who comes to us not as sovereign Lord, but as our equal. And in this struggle, God drains us of all self-reliance. Personal worth is replaced with exhaustion. Faith is no longer a firm foundation, so we have no other choice but to rely on the one who rejects us. Faced with rejection, Jesus looked only to the God who rejected him, and by this, Jesus' faith in God was perfected. And so it is with us. Some years ago, a well-to-do layman was asked to speak a word of encouragement to a minister who had lost his position. Happened right here on this campus. He responded with these touching words, I don't like to see a grown man cry. Come across hard times, and you will see less and less of old friends. That's Gethsemane. As Jesus struggles with God, three friends have found sweet refuge in groggy sleep, only to be intermittently awoken by the pathetic groans of a man caught in the clutches of death, hell, and Satan. And when the arrest comes, you can hear Peter, James, and John say, we don't like to see a grown man suffer. And then add these words. They're your words. We're out of here. Jesus knew it would happen. Slay the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock will be scattered. Even told a parable about it. The five sleeping virgins were not prepared for the hour of redemption in which the bridegroom would go to his death. There is something about this perfidy in the judgment of the sheep and the goats. It was not that Peter, James, and John did not see Christ in destitute Christians. They did not see Christ in the destitute Jesus. Rather than standing by a suffering friend in whose agony God was bringing salvation, they took the safer road, well worn by the priest and the Levite. We don't like to see a grown man suffer, even if it is Jesus. Give me Easter, you can have Gethsemane. The first lesson of Gethsemane is that Jesus really believed that his prayers could change God's mind. The second is even though God could rearrange things, he didn't. Our salvation was more important than the relieving the agony of his son. In saying no to Jesus, God said yes to us. The third point is that betrayal and disloyalty within the church have been there from the beginning. Hidden within the kiss of peace was the knife of death. And three close friends, as they moved from that garden, may have qualified for the marathon. I'm out of here. A footnote to this nadir point in apostolic history summarizes the shame. Three disciples leave, but a young man has been in the garden and is to watch and arrest, which even at that time was one of huge proportions. A soldier reaches out to grab him, but he gets the one piece of clothing covering the body. He runs away, but with no clothing. The shame of his desertion is made obvious by his nakedness. Mark may have been reworking the Genesis account of Adam running away from God, covering up the shame of his nakedness. Mark may have also been making a cameo appearance in his own gospel. All this is probable. But reading this story only once does not do the job. Read it enough times and you might find that this story is about you. That's what Isaiah said centuries before Christ came. All we like sheep have gone astray. And the words of Zechariah found their way in the mouth of Jesus. Strike the shepherd. The sheep of the flock will be scattered. Law, gospel, whatever it is, this would be a good point to end the sermon. But why? What was repulsive to the disciples in Gethsemane became the centerpiece of what they preached. But this was not enough that Christ's agony was preached. That's not enough. It's not enough that it be believed. But it was replayed within their own bodies. And this agony continues to be chiseled out in martyred bodies even to this day. And the deaths of these martyrs are the purest proclamation of the gospel. If you have not already prayed, if it is possible, remove this cup from me, someday you will. The first time you pray that prayer, the divine answer might be okay. One day it'll be the same answer that Jesus got.